Welcome to NavChat, the show for the New Zealand orienteering and navigation sports community.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Gene. How's it going?
Yeah, I'm well. I've had a good December. Some good adventures. What are you up to?
It's been a month of time on the bike for me, really, but in between some cycling, we've had a couple of training nights up here in Whangarei that have been quite fun. Bit of experimentation with trying to get more people on training exercises at all different levels. So, yeah, been cool.
Sweet. Any personal adventures?
We've actually kept it pretty local. Have headed up into the hills that we like look at from our house just here in Whangarei, right on the edge of town, taken a topo map and gone exploring. Kind of good for, probably better for like Rogaine style or adventure racing navigation. Yeah. But any time with map in hand, I reckon is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, that's sweet. There is a lot of emphasis on Rogaine and adventure racing at the moment. So I think that's what we're hoping to focus on today. We've got a lot of stuff on Rogaining and planning. So we'll get into some of the topics that we're interested in covering and see what we can learn.
And cool. Who did you speak to this month, Gene? And tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, so the guest this month is Tim Farrant. So he must be my age. We kind of grew up together doing orienteering at club level, and he moved more into Rogaining and has really become quite a talent over the past 5 to 10 years, and is up there with the big boys, and was in a mixed team this year at the New Zealand Rogaine Champs and did really well. So
second overall, yeah, right, him and Joe?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And he's very experienced and has done a lot of stuff overseas. So I sat down with him and talked about New Zealand Rogaine Champs and how he approaches this challenging planning exercise and also challenging execution.
Cool. All right. Let's have a listen.
Yeah. Let's check out Tim.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Hi, Tim. Yes, I can hear you. Thanks for coming on NavChat. I'm looking forward to hearing about the very cold weekend a few weeks back. And I'm interested to hear about the planning process, especially of the Rogaine and how that is reflected in your choice of controls at daytime and nighttime and early in the course and late in the course. So can you talk us through what happens when you get given a map like this and you have your planning time and what kind of things you're looking at?
Yeah, thanks, Gene. Thanks first for the opportunity to be on NavChat. It's you've got the map up in front of the screen there. Basically, whenever I plan a Rogaine, tend to spend quite a lot of time looking at the map beforehand. So for a World Champs or a 24-hour event like the New Zealand Champs, you tend to get sort of about half, well, about three hours or thereabouts to plan your course, which sounds like quite a lot of time, but you do use it all up quite quickly. Everyone was lined up sort of at the registration, ready to get their maps right on the dot at 9 o'clock in the morning. And we spent 3 hours sort of working on our course plan from there.
So are you at first looking at the terrain on the map, or are you going straight into planning it? How much time do you spend solely looking at the nature of the terrain?
I probably spent about half an hour just sort of trying to get my head around how much course there is, and just look at the terrain, see where the high points are, and try and start making some obvious loops. What I do, and a number of people do this, is I get a big plastic sheet and I put it over the map and I start trying to link up obvious loops. The easiest place to start is often the corners of the map, which is quite a long way from the start and finish normally. So with this map in particular, you might see 102 in the top left-hand corner.
Yeah.
So if you sort of scroll over that, now that 102, you'll see, it's just up a little bit there. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's sort of only one way in and one way out. So in order to pick that up, you're going to have to come either from the 79 or from the 95. So that would be a starting point. And then once you're at the 79, it's kind of clear you have to get to the 71. There's not another obvious route there. So then you've got another link. And from the 95, similarly, there's probably not another way to pick up the 65. So very quickly, this corner is starting to become quite well defined with how you pick your route through it. Another area is you'll notice just up slightly from this. So if you go slightly further north.
Our drawings move.
So there's a loop there with a 101 at the top of the ski field.
Where's 101?
Just on the left side.
Oh, yep.
Here it is. So with this one, you have to pick up this obvious set. And from 101, logical route seems to be down the ridge to the 81.
Right. So you've got these little, how many little segments like this do you create?
Well, I create as many as I can. So just working around. And then what I do from there is I'll link them up to sort of form a starting point for a course. So at this stage, once I've linked them all up, I might even have 90% of the course in there at that stage, with the only controls missing are the ones that are a little bit difficult to link up.
Okay. But that's far more than all of the you know you're going to have to shave some of those controls out.
Yeah, but I probably want to try and get 85% of them or something.
Okay.
As a first loop. So at that point, I'll measure the distance. So with a piece of string or something like that, work out exactly how far it would be to do the full loop as planned. And then with this particular course, picking out what I could, it looked like it was going to be about 108K.
Okay.
That was doing that exercise over most of the map. And I knew that was too long, so it became sort of a trading off which loop was going to be done preference for another one.
Cool. Let's have a look at what you did end up doing. So we've got it on roganresults.com here. So you can see those sections that we talked about before, although you changed the plan slightly around 30, and we can see some of the links. Yeah. Some of the links there. So you can see that there's also some clear ways to link up, say 106 to 98 to 69. Was that an area that you had drawn up a kind of, you'd link them together, but then discarded that at some stage?
Yeah. So we did link those up, but we worked out that distance and climb wise, they were going to be,
kind of these guys here.
Yeah. That they were a lot further spaced apart than the ones further to the north there.
Yep.
So they became our lowest priority loop.
Mm-hmm. Cool. How did you improvise once you're against the clock? Were there changes that you made to the route, and how did you handle any surprises out on course?
We actually started off reasonably well controlled. So if you scroll down a little bit, we started off with, we just picked up a 20 pointer on the way out and then got straight into the bigger points, the 100 and the 85.
Yep.
I think that was something that we did that was a bit different to the teams around us that spent a bit more time.
It's very tempting to get the 39 and the 34 and the 24. They're all pretty easy pickings.
Yeah, I guess I felt that even if we wasted 10 minutes, it was probably too long picking up those because we had to prioritize getting over these high points while we were fresh and had the daylight and the weather. So we actually, everything went fairly well to plan right through to about 57. And at that point, we actually decided to add a loop. So we hadn't originally planned to head down to the... you go down a little bit.
Oh, yep. Down these guys here.
So we hadn't planned to pick up 105 and 97. But the travel looked very good down to 105. And...
as seen from 57?
Yeah. So we sort of looked and it was quite open travel. So at least picking up the 105 looked quite good. And then it was just a judgment call about whether we'd try and make the loop through 97. And so we actually did a bush bash from 105 down to 97.
What was the initial plan from 57?
It was to back out and go around to 65.
Oh, yeah. Just stay high.
Yep. Keep the height.
Interesting. Cool. Some good improvisation. Do you try to make a distinction between the types of control points you're getting at daytime versus nighttime?
I think for this particular course, we were just trying to get through the highest elevation controls as quickly as possible. Because there was a weather front coming in at midnight. It's sort of like it was a gate that was going to shut on you.
Yep.
So...
Do you have any preference about the type of controls you would usually try to get during the daytime as opposed to nighttime? Or are you pretty confident going for any kind of control at nighttime?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a balance. So we were probably less strong navigationally than the teams we were up against. Particularly Georgia and Tane, we knew we were going to be very strong. And Phil Wood and Angie West as well was another quite navigation strong team. So we were probably always trying to err on the side of easier controls during the night just to limit that risk of losing time from navigation mistakes. And I think it worked well with us coming down. You'll notice we came through the road, some quite long road sections.
So it's very reliable. I'm trying to pick off some of these spurs and valleys at nighttime if you don't have good visibility, I imagine is just an additional risk that you wouldn't have during the daytime, whether you have huge visibility.
Yeah. I mean, to put a couple of things in context, I guess, we actually going from 81 to 77, we had a go at getting 77 and we probably missed it by 50 meters and we ended up losing 15, 20 minutes there just by missing a meter Gary Bushway, a very small distance in the dark. And then similarly, 80, we lost time with a rock outcrop, and there was about four or five rock outcrops. And so, you get the wrong one, you spend quite a lot of time hunting around. You notice control 50 there was part of our plan to go 76 to 50. The description was a small tree or something, but just looking from the road, there were quite a few small trees and essentially you'd be wading through small trees trying to get to 50. And
right.
So it's a little bit like a needle in a haystack. I wasn't going to try my luck.
That's really interesting. But at daytime, you would have had no problems.
Yeah, I think you probably would have picked it from the road.
Yeah. Interesting. And what was what were the conditions like once that front came through? And did that affect the way that you tackled this last portion of the course?
It probably actually affected the way we approached the entire course. It's quite tempting, I think, when you're racing to look at the compulsory gear list and decide that's basically your packing list for what you're taking on the race. But I've found with events in the past, particularly God Zone and things like that, is that you pack everything on the compulsory gear list, but then it doesn't include things like socks and stuff like that, which are also quite nice. So you have to be a bit careful. And in this particular event, we actually both took fleeces and a spare thermal as well. So you could take the lightest gear possible, but we had to take quite a bit more than the minimum. And we took overtrav as well. They weren't compulsory. Thermals were. So we actually took them around on our first 8 hours of course, and then we left our extra gear at the all-night cafe. So not every Rogaine has this, but
yeah.
This event had what's called a bush cafe or an all-night cafe at about halfway around. And so we got there at about 7.5-8 hours, and we went there and we dropped some gear before we went up the hill 21. And so we dropped gear and food, and we were able to pick that back up on the loop back around.
Nice. Cool. Well, thanks for taking us through the course. It certainly looks pretty tough, and yeah, the conditions did seem quite trying, and I think that's probably fitting. I think that's the rugged test of mental and physical endurance that everyone signed up for. It sounds like they got it, and I'm sure people will find your process around planning and executing the Rogaine really interesting. So thanks for sharing, Tim.
Yeah, thanks, Gene. We in the second half there, I might just add a little bit. From 103, you notice we took a bit of a strange line to 87.
Oh, yeah, it looks like you've missed a couple. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So that point in the course, the snow had started settling, and there was about probably about 50 mils of snow had built up. And all of the broom bushes had sort of like folded over. And so we would have had to have waded through broom bushes to go up to 73. It probably would have ended up, I simply don't think we would have made it up there. So we went to back out. Now you look at the map and it looks quite clear coming out to the road.
Yeah.
That was our escape route. But Rogaine Max can be a bit different sometimes, yeah. So what it didn't show there is there was actually a bit of a gorge. You can pick a little bit
from it.
But there was also a whole lot of wilding pines in there, and it was actually quite thick as well to get through there. So, our fastest route probably would have been to go back up to 89. But, you sort of just see how you go sometimes. But it's... that's one thing, is that I think you've got to anticipate the map won't have everything you need in a Rogaine, whereas in orienteering you sort of have a bit more detail and a bit more confidence. So
definitely a great point, having that contingency, and in some of these tight situations, the knowledge that you can get out and around without losing too much time is quite valuable.
Yeah, like particularly at night, like if the map isn't particularly accurate, if you can, if you can see a wee bit more, you don't end up in those challenging situations as much. So, it's, even experienced navigators will lose a lot of time at night in a Rogaine, whereas orienteering maybe not so.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you, Tim.
Oh, thanks, Gene.
There's some interesting stuff there from Tim.
Yeah, I was a little surprised. I thought that the planning would be much more like my style of planning, but it's pretty clear that people are successful doing whatever works for them. And I should probably talk to more of these guys because they're clearly onto it and clearly successful. And I think you get stuck in your own way of doing things. So hearing from someone else was really valuable, and I'm looking forward to catching up with more of these guys in the future. What did you take away?
Well, I've always been on that other side of the competition from Tim, so I've never really had a chance to see his style of planning. So I think that was a bit of an insight into the competition. But I really like that string use. He's not the first person I've heard that has used a measured string to kind of get the distance right. I personally, that's what I'm going to take away. I'm going to go and measure up my string for a 1 in 50,000 map and give that a try. But the other thing that struck me was the way they changed the plan out there.
Yeah.
I think that obviously they thought about more than just the map and the terrain. They thought about the weather. But I was interested that they were like happy to like add that extra loop in partway around. Mm-hmm. I guess that's probably why they spend so long at the start, just trying to get a feel for the map so you can make those on the fly decisions. I have tried to stop myself from doing that previously. So again, maybe something worth incorporating into Rogaine plans. And lastly, I think New Zealand Rogaine Champs is a little bit different from lots of orienteering score events in that you often, well, almost always won't get all of the controls. And Rogaining's always harder when you're trying to make those choices between what do I take and what do I leave. And I think, yeah, that's the hardest part. And that definitely looked like that was something that they executed pretty well, bypassing low points controls to go for the big points in other places.
Mm-hmm.
Should we jump into a bit of a deeper dive into this and look at another way, kind of a way that's maybe a bit more suited to like your kind of analytical sort of mind in terms of planning for Rogaines? Because I think there's, as you said before, there are many ways to skin a cat when it comes to planning a Rogaine. So maybe if we run through your methodology, yeah, we'll have a look at mine afterwards and people can pull out stuff from Tim, the Rogaine extraordinaire, Gene, who's very much an orienteer, and me, who's kind of in the middle with a little bit of both. So what, how do you plan a Rogaine? What do you think about?
Yeah, let's take a look. So I've prepared some information here, and we'll take a minute to get into what's up on the screen here. So we've got a Rogaine map that was done a month or so ago. This was held by Northwest Orienteering Club. It's a map on the Kaipara, alongside the Kaipara Harbour, hilly farmland with patches of manuka and some other mixed trees. 30 yep. control points. The points are worth either 30, 40, or 50. So not a huge range compared to like the Rogaine that Tim was dealing with, where you had quite a big range of the low points to the high points.
Cool. And this map's 1 to 10,000, right?
Yep, 1 to 10,000 and ISOM symbols. So, and brand new as well, so very accurate.
Cool.
What I've got on the left here is a list of all the legs that I completed on the course. And you can see that I've labeled them here on the map, each control, 1, 2, 3, 4, to try to help you out. So you can see on the left, start to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4. That's what I'm referring to here, 3 to 4, 4 to 5. And then I've got the split time. So I've used QuickRoute, the software that I did a tutorial on previously that people should check out on the leg by leg series if they want. And I've measured the time between each of these control points, which is this split time column. Then the next column in this table is, and yeah, with the split time column, the ones that are most green are the shortest splits and the red ones are the slowest splits. And in the points column, we've got the number of points that I've assigned to each leg. And this is a bit of a conceptual shift that I think is really important to get your head around. And this is, I think a really key part of this concept is each leg I've assigned points from the two neighboring controls. So this leg from 2 to 3 has, I've considered to have the points from the 50 points. I've considered to have half of those points, so 25, and half of the points from the 48, which is half of that is 20 points.
Okay.
So this leg from number 2 to number 3, I've said has 45 points associated with it.
And yeah, I guess that's relevant because it's not just where you're going, it's where you've come from to get there too. So
that's right. A leg is defined by two control points, not one control point. And that's an important concept. And if you didn't get that, re-listen to it until it sinks in. And now the points per minute is simply the third column is the number of points in the previous column divided by the time. And that gives you a sense of the efficiency or the speed at which you're accumulating points as you travel through the terrain. And I think that's the metric where after here in Rogaining. And if you're trying to make a comparison between should I do a loop over here or a loop over there, like those little loops that Tim was talking about, you want to be able to compare them in the number of points per minute to see where the good value is at.
Totally. And especially important if you're going to miss out controls, because if you're trying to get all of the controls, you just want the shortest distance really. But here, when potentially some have to be missed, efficiency is the name of the game.
Exactly right. So let's take a look at this points per minute column. The ones that are red, the low points, are really low value. So the lowest I'm getting is 7 points per minute.
9 to 10.
So let's have a look at 9 to 10. Like, what kind of situation would cause us to only get 7 points per minute? So 9 is down here in this big valley, and you can see that I've got to climb 15 contours up this slope, and then I've got to go down a steep slope a little bit as well to get down to 10. So it's pretty slow going, and the points that I'm getting, although is high, 45 points associated with that leg, thanks to the contribution from a 40-pointer and a 50-pointer. The points per minute is low, and that number is what matters, because it takes me so long to get between those two control points. Let's take a look at...
Interesting.
Yeah, let's take a look at a better value leg. We'll jump to the one we were looking at earlier, control number 2 to 3. It is a bit shorter than that leg from 9 to 10, but not that much shorter. The contours are quite different. I think when I looked at this leg, my intuition would suggest that this leg is maybe twice as good value. You know, you're going to be going maybe twice as fast because it's flat as opposed to hilly, but there's also some forest to slow you down. And yeah, but the numbers here actually show that the points per minute from 2 to 3 is 23 points per minute compared to 7 in that previous leg. So it's more than 3 times as valuable to go from 2 to 3 as it is to go from 9 to 10 down here. Should we have a look at a few more legs?
Yeah, I was going to say 19 to 20 because that looks pretty good. 21 to 22 it is. So that one there looks like it is just off the map there.
Mm-hmm.
That is almost one of your highest value legs.
Yep.
But to me, that looks like it's through green, it's steep.
Yeah.
I would not have thought that was 3 times as valuable as that other one.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's good to do the maths and actually calibrate your intuition. So I'd recommend that each time people do a Rogaine, they do this analysis afterwards, trace it out on Quick Route, measure the split times, and then calculate the points per minute for each leg. And you'll find that some legs, like 22 to 21 here, gives me 26 points per minute, whereas some other neighboring legs are a lower value. So this one, 22 to 23, obviously in this Rogaine, you kind of have to do them all together, but it's about calibrating your intuition. So when the moment comes to make a decision between doing one thing or another thing, you've got a good sense of exactly how much faster or how much more points per minute you're getting with one option over another. So this leg from 21 to 22 gives me 26 points per minute, but from 22 to 23 only gives me 15 points per minute. And just to really... let that sink in, just how big of a difference that level of points per minute is.
I guess, so what you're saying is, like, rather than getting the spreadsheet and the calculator out in the planning time for one of these Rogaines,
yeah,
you should do this afterwards for a few Rogaines to help calibrate your internal sense of what's fast and what's not.
Exactly. And it's the same with route choice planning for orienteering. You kind of have to do it and then measure it afterwards to see what was fastest or not, unless you have a partner out there to, you know, go 2 different ways and
mm-hmm.
and measure up. You need that feedback. Like, just doing a leg and not knowing if it was the fastest way or the slowest way, but that doesn't help you, because you still could be doing it the slow way and just practicing doing it the slow way. You have to get some feedback. So I recommend that Rogainers do this kind of thing.
Okay, so if we were to just say you've done this for this event, mm-hmm. what were your takeaways for this new farmland and Manuka map up in Auckland, quite specific terrain, but I guess there are a few maps around like this. Mm-hmm. What were your key learnings for future Rogaines here?
I think the key learnings is that some of these, the legs that are better value, that I think I feel a better value just from looking at the map, like these flatter ones around 1, 2, 3, are much better value than I thought. So, it's about getting that right, because there will be a point where you've got a high value control at the top of a hill, but if you don't know just how inefficient it is in terms of points per minute to get that really high control at the top of the hill, then you might be tempted you might be tempted to get it. So what I got from this is think about how much better it is on the flat and like double your expectations.
Okay. So it kind of emphasize the need to be cautious of extra height gain if you can avoid it.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool. Okay. That's something which I know, like maybe Slater Road or Turkey Ridge could be comparable to this map.
Yeah.
And it was always, I never quantified it, but there always did seem to be benefits in trying to minimize your climb.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Right. Definitely.
All right. What about July? I mean, that's very analytical, but I'm perhaps not the most analytical numbers-based person. Shall I run through kind of what I think about?
Yeah. How about let's look at this. This is a Rogaine that, as far as I'm aware, you haven't seen before. You were not in Auckland when this got done. So this is in Riverhead Forest the month prior. And the points here are 30, 40, and 50.
Yeah. Okay.
Each. So.
And it's an hour?
It's 90 minutes.
90 minutes. Okay. All right. Okay. Interesting. So if I was to say what I do in one of these Rogaines, first thing I do is I just get a little bit of a look and a feel for the map. What is, just like Tim, where are the hills? What's the terrain like? How green is it? Then I think my thing is density. I try and look at density of points and try and cluster controls. So I can see there's that little cluster in the northwest of the map, around 53, 41, 42, this little bit here, maybe excluding 30, but that those are there. So that's a load of points really close together. The other cluster that stands out to me is the 57, 55, 50, 45, that valley.
Down to 52? Or maybe
not, yeah. No, not even that far, just that little bit there. So those are two areas that I want to kind of join together. The rest of the map, there's not really a super high density area.
So why are you choosing this area as kind of separate to this area?
So for me, that the 57, 55, 50 is basically one valley, and they're all high points controls, whereas 36, 44, 37, 52, they're just not quite as close, and there's a bit more contour between them, and it's like a bit messy.
Yeah, so you look at the height probably, difference. Contour here is... Is that contour there? That's the contour above it. This guy, these are on the same height. And then that's straight down the spur to that guy. So
exactly, yeah. Whereas efficient. These, and it, so I, this other group you mentioned, they're a bit more lower points as well.
Yeah, they've got some 30s in here. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, you can, if you spend enough time, you kind of need to vibe it a little bit, I think. If you can spend a lot of time thinking, oh, everywhere's dense. But those areas to me leap out.
Mm-hmm.
So then the next thing I like to do is I like to work backwards, because I think that you need to give yourself options at the end in case you run out of time. Now, the big challenge on this one is that 51 and that 56 down in the north, in the southeast of the map. A long way away, but high points and very committing. So
what do you mean by committing? Well,
if you're going to go to them, you've got a long dead run to get there and very few points on the way back. If you go out there, you're going to have that 6 to 8 minutes to get there and 6 to 8 minutes out. So you've got to be prepared that you're going to be putting aside 15 plus minutes and you're going to be a long way away. So there's an opportunity cost. You could be getting other controls at that time. Mm-hmm. So I've just sort of filed that away. But then I think backwards. So where is the nicest way to come back with loads of options where you could have a plan B, a plan C, and I think that's probably coming in via 40, 31, 48, 38. So like the just north of the finish. So I'd probably zigzag my way through those, because if I was short of time, I could just go from 40 to 31 to finish. Whereas if I'm sticking to my time plan, I can get 48 and 38. Whereas if we look the other way to enter back into the finish via 59, 33, 58, if you're running short on time, you can't really save any distance.
Yeah, that's funny you say that, because I was basically at 34 and I was like, there's one way back from here.
Yeah, you can jump on the road and miss.
I was under the pressure. Yeah, it was so inefficient would have been to jump on this road and just miss all those points. Yeah.
Yeah, so for me right there, I've got the basis of my course. So I know I'm going to start 59.
Yeah.
Real tempting to get 38, but it's only 30 points, and we'll leave it for the end. So 58, just what you've drawn there, up to 34. then I've got a decision point. If it was, if I was going for the lot, which is massively tempting in these row games.
Yeah.
I would probably, well, it's hard as, I'd be inclined to get 51, 56 and miss 46.
Oh, yep. So there's an options there if you do that, yeah, yep. Through these guys.
Yep. So I'd do,
This is the other option.
Yeah. So if it was 60 minutes, I would, no way would I be going to 51 or 56. But that's 100 points, whereas if I go the other way, there's only 70 points there. And if I'm going good, I might be able to get that 32. So, yeah, I'd pop up to 51, 56, come back to 35, and then I would go up into my first high-density area, 55, 50, and conserve my height. Then I would potentially miss 37, get the 43, 44, 36, 52, bridge up to 30 and then into the other density area and then probably up the track to 54 and then zigzag my way through here and then we've got the finish. Now, the last thing I'd do is I'd think about some rough time cuts. So how long do I think things are going to take me? I think that from 30 to the finish would probably be about, I'd probably want to have at least 25 minutes there approximately. Now, don't ask me how I arrived at that number. It just it looks like it would take longer than 20 and less than 30. I guess that's from running.
I think this is a great point, is you extract that number from your intuition.
Yeah.
You've done this enough times and studied you've got feedback from the times you've failed and the times you've succeeded to get a good sense of how long it takes per leg. So just like what I was suggesting before, you need to get the feedback some way so that you can actually pull off that calculation based on intuition, because there's no really other way to calculate it other than just doing this repetition.
Exactly. And I guess you can do it in probably the best way to learn is probably to try and write it down or have some sort of systematic way of doing it rather than repetitive trial and error, which is kind of how I've learned it, I guess. The other thing I would probably comment on this map is we talked a lot about height on that previous Rogaine map. I don't think you can underestimate vegetation change, and that's not only on an orienteering map like this, but we heard Tim mentioning that on a topo map as well, that vegetation can be a massive factor in your speed.
Mm-hmm.
So don't make sure you don't just look at the points, the controls, you look at the climb associated and also the vegetation associated. So out of interest, you didn't do the same thing. Sounds like when you did this, you went a different way.
I didn't get those. I sacrificed them and got all of these ones in between. And that was the most efficient way. I think if you approached it this way, I think you would have found yourself getting through here with a lot more time. If you were in good physical shape, you personally would have found yourself at 36 or 52 with much more than 25 minutes. And I think at that stage, you would have then replanned and tried to get in these guys. And you would have done well. But there was this really uncanny spot on the day where there were a lot of people who took on 51 to 56 who were not quite as strong as you and therefore had to miss out more easy pointers over there. So you really have to know your strengths. And there's this uncanny spot where people were fit enough to be tempted for 51 and 56, but not fast enough to actually get back and get all the higher value ones. I think you could have pulled it off just.
Would have been tight. Would have been very tight, I think. But that's a good row game. That's a well-set row game.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Enticing you to leave controls.
Yeah, that cool. Kind of uncanny area played into my advantage because I wasn't. I was actually just walking because I'm injured, walking aggressively, but still just walking. And so I wasn't tempted at all. And that kind of played into my advantage because everyone who was running, aside from Nick Harris, who I did the leg by leg video with, got tempted and it kind of backfired on them. So I was pretty sneaky to pull out a good result in that one.
Yeah. So you mentioned those leg by legs. You did a couple of analyses of this with a few people.
Yeah, that's right. We'll jump over to have a look. look quickly. So we've got the Riverhead Rogaine leg by leg, talking to Nick Harris, and we talk about his process and also my process. So it's great now that we've got kind of three people all talking about the slightly different ways to approach that one. There's also leg by leg 12 on Te Reo Pariri, the map that I had up earlier for the analysis. And that was done with Cam Delisle, who absolutely smashed it. And we just hear about his reasoning behind which legs were high value and which ones weren't. So I think that's an essential listen. Also, yeah, he's a good navigator, and it's definitely one targeted at more advanced orienteers who are, yeah, really looking at some of the finer points of Roganing. Whereas the one with Nick, I think, is more broadly about some fundamentals.
Cool. So great for friends who are adventure racers or road gainers as well to have a little bit of a tune-up.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Now, orienteering has continued. Let's move on to chatting about what's happening in orienteering around the country. There's been plenty on, even though it's kind of tail end of the season normally. You have been down at the ONZ under-23 camp.
Yeah, what's been
happening there?
So every year we have an under-23 camp with the juniors and some people who are just out of juniors and still looking towards the competitive end of orienteering. And we take them through some unfamiliar terrain and give them some challenging exercises and really drill down into some of the key techniques for orienteering at a performance level. This is Teetotal Flat near St. Arnold, Nelson Lakes.
Yep.
Yeah. And we've got GPS trackers on them. So we were getting the tracking data throughout the day and then reviewing it at nighttime and discussing the exercises and what we are hoping to achieve, and just having good, robust discussion about people's habits and which are good habits, what are bad habits, and how they responded to this challenging terrain, which is very unfamiliar to a number of them and is certainly not my wheelhouse either.
Mm. So just for people who might not have been, who haven't been to one of these camps before, this looks like a couple of different courses. Just as an example, how did it kind of work on this day? Was it specific skills focused on, or what was the deal?
Yeah, so in this particular exercise, we were doing a partner's relocation type exercise. So we didn't actually have this map that you can see here. Between the partners, you would have every second control. So I would have 1, 3, 5, and the other partner would have 2, 4, 6. And so they would be navigating to that spot and then drop you off. And you'd have to then relocate and then navigate to the next control.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. And nice exercise. You can do that without a map too. You can just get someone to hide their map away and then go and relocate again. Okay. Nice.
Yeah. And it gets very tricky in some of the terrain up here. Like I got dropped off at 7, having not read the map, and there's definitely some challenge about determining which spur you're on, especially as the visibility was a bit lower, and we had come through all of this mess to get there, so it's pretty hard to remember what you'd crossed.
So definitely some challenging ones. And were there any other examples of the trainings down there?
Yeah, this was also on the same day. This was
testing longer legs
on the West Bay map, just across the road from Teetotal Flat. Mm-hmm. And just a terrifying area for navigation.
It's one of our most technical maps, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This is pretty hard. And the mapping is maybe getting a little bit older now, but it's still pretty good. The vegetation growth is pretty slow.
I had probably one of my worst ever orienteering experiences on this map.
You are not the only person.
Yeah. It's an amazing challenge when you're having a good day, but if you're having a bad day, it's tough. And I can imagine long legs. I mean, super hard to run long legs in this terrain. A moment's lapsed concentration, you're in trouble.
Yeah, there's too many repeating features. The visibility is too low. Relocating in this is terrible. So you have to maintain pretty much perfect contact the whole time. Very challenging exercise, and definitely one that's targeted at elite level orienteering, where you're really pushing the boundaries on how much you have to read the map and what's most important to read and what you can ignore.
There's probably a bit more about the camp in Malcolm's High Performance News, which is on the ONZ website, and the junior camp has been being held down there this last week as well.
Yeah.
A kind of institution of New Zealand orienteering. I have fond memories from there. I'm sure you do too. So maybe we can talk about some of the exercises they did next month. Sticking in Nelson, they've been active with club events. They used Cane and Downs, which is an old ex-nationals map, karst terrain up on Takaka Hill. It's a pretty cool area. You must have run there a few times.
I have run there once or twice before, so it was still fairly unfamiliar to me when we did the exercises on this at the under 23 camp as well. This is the course from a Nelson club event a few weeks earlier.
Yeah,
I don't have the course from the under 23 camp, but you can get an idea of how interesting this terrain is just by looking at these areas with the big holes, these big depressions. It's pretty staggering terrain. And
some of them may be slightly bigger than some of the maps suggest as well.
I'm suspecting there's some 10 to 15 meter contours in some of these depressions. I think Nelson's kind of in the right place, but there's some big holes. It's almost terrifying. You see these holes just disappear into the ground. You don't want to fall into these things.
I think Nelson's working through a remap of it at the moment. This event, at one of the naturalised Scotsmen in New Zealand, Callum Coombs, was fastest, I think. And I think you caught up with Zephyr Fave, who might have been second on the day and did a leg-by-leg on this one too.
Yeah, that's right. I did a leg-by-leg with Zephyr Fave, and he's a young orienteer, but his process is very thorough and he's very consistent. He's just so relaxed about the quality of his orienteering, so it's really nice to listen to.
Cool. Keeping things in the top of the south, Nelson's paired club, Marlborough, they've had a bunch of events over the last few months, and that includes the Polaris Challenge, which is like an inter-club OY series between Nelson and Marlborough. You basically need to go to one event at least of the other club to count for the overall. Really cool idea. And they had a double header recently, including this map here, Cape Campbell, which is kind of near Ward and has been used for South Island Champs previously. Some fairly grunty contours in there, but also interesting little bit of forest too.
Yeah, I have run here before when they did South Island Champs, and that's a beautiful little block of forest to run through, just pine needles on the ground, and contours very flowy, push you around a little bit as well.
Nice. So they've got results from their Polaris Challenge up on their website, but I think that's a cool idea. Those inter-club competitions are always really good. Shifting slightly north to the Manawatu, we had the Pukapu or Central Champs. Not the large fields we've seen elsewhere. I think uni exams and end of year and all that caught up with it a little bit. But some pretty fun courses nonetheless. This course, for example, does an excellent job of really pushing the challenge of crossing in and out of these vegetation blocks, something which the Nationals middle did really well as well.
Mm-hmm.
I would have loved to be able to make it down there. I had work commitments, unfortunately, but sound weekend of orienteering.
Yeah, I love these optimization problems here where you've got this faster track that runs a longer distance, and then there's the option of going perfectly straight. And usually the best option is some combination of the two when you're cutting at an angle across these tracks. And so it's very interesting to run and just think about at which stage you can see Lara here has been running on the track for a certain distance. When do you leave the track? Do you leave it at the junction and go straight, or do you wait till even later? There's a lot of thinking to do on these legs to get it perfect and save yourself as much time as possible. There's also just the fear of getting lost. Like some of the stuff is dynamite when you screw it up.
And I mean, interesting on that leg, just watching those tracks there, look like Lara and Liz even almost the same way. It's like you said, there's multiple options.
Yeah.
But they almost went identical routes, which is interesting.
Both skilled navigators and just doing that optimization with intuition since they've practiced this so many times before.
Nice. So that was Pukapu Champs.
There's also a leg by leg on this one. So we've been getting pretty good coverage with the leg by legs, and this is also an advanced one. for people who are interested in going deep from the elite women's race.
Cool, cool. Heading way, way further south down to Invercargill area, my enthusiasm was, or curiosity was piqued when I saw this map. This is not from Denmark. It's, in fact, from Southland Orienteering Club. A fascinating looking map with heaps of contour detail, bunch of vegetation change. I would love to run on it.
It looks very detailed. I'm very surprised. I've never heard of this area. Obviously, I haven't been down to Southland very often, but this is tempting me. This is very cool stuff. And I do like the rough vegetation as well. It's something that is the opposite to what we get here in Auckland, where our detailed sand dunes have such consistent and even vegetation, whereas this is very choppy. There's little fast bits of vegetation and then really slow bits all mixed together.
Yeah, quite compact too. I liked the look of it. Now, Nelson and Marlborough weren't the only interclub competition taking place. The Battle of the Bays between Hawke's Bay, Orienteering Bay Plenty, and Taupo took place. Historically, a competition between Taupo and Hawke's Bay, OBOP were invited this time and promptly proceeded to win the interclub challenge.
Never invited back.
We can see the trophy there. And we've got a snap of the map as well from Greg Flynn. This is for Kaipo Bay, a map that will be familiar to many North Islanders and South Islanders too. Used in Waitangi Carnival, many Katoa Po, right on the shores of Lake Taupo. The comment I heard was that even for people who knew the area well, it was tough. There were some new challenges, and I could be wrong here, but I think they've pushed the map out a little, just a little around the margins. But it's always tricky. It's got these awesome little steep-sided gullies and re-entrants, which you can't really get a good sense of until you're in them. The other thing on this, which I quite liked, was down in the control descriptions. You've got Battle of the Bays, long red, 5.4 kilometres, and then the climb box, heaps.
Precise.
Just being honest, I like it. I mentioned right at the start that we'd done a little bit of a few training exercises up here in Whangarei. The goal was to try and do some beginner trainings, and I've not really done much beginner coaching before, so it was really just a bit of experimentation, trying to do something that was scalable, that the club could get more people out and get a good bang for buck from relatively few coaches. Learned a few things about suitable terrains and how fast you should go and things like that. But it was great, a great way to spend a summer evening in Northland, all without the admin required for a full event. So I don't know, maybe we'll talk about this in the months to come, some practical advice for training sessions. Looking ahead to upcoming events, we've got Nationals, and a recent bulletin came out from Northwest on the ONZ website. Talks lots about Woodhill. I don't know about you, Gene, but I'm fizzing for that terrain. It's going to be good. We know Woodhill's amazing to run in. The thing, though, that looked really interesting was where they've selected for the sprint. I was thinking maybe Massey Uni, which was previously embargoed, but they've actually gone for Long Bay College, which here is a satellite shot. And the embargoed area doesn't just include the college. It includes some of the suburban streets nearby, so just to the southeast, and this kind of creek sort of setup that runs down to this lake. So actually quite a varied map.
Yeah, that's right. We've got the typical detailed campus juxtaposed against this blocky residential area. And then I don't know what the stream's like, whether there's little foot trails and stuff in there. So, yeah, it could be quite varied.
The last time I ran Long Bay, and you've probably run it more often than I have, was one of the Sprint Auckland days. And I remember it being quite intricate. It's got a little bit of height change through it. It's got lots of covered walkways. It's actually very, very detailed. I think that'll be interesting.
Yeah, looking forward to it. I think these map samples here, I mean, they get me pretty excited. I'm actually involved with course setting controlling for the long distance.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, personally, I'm really excited about the terrain that we've got on offer there.
So cool. I won't push you for any information. You can
no, you won't. You won't be squeezing any details out of me, other than what's visible here. I mean, it says it all. It's incredible terrain, and people should not miss out on Nationals next year.
Lock in Easter. And then you spotted some stuff over on Orienteering Mappers International.
Yeah. Tell us
about it.
For anyone who's interested in mapping and keeping up with some very good discussions from the international mapping community, I'd really recommend they check out the Facebook page, Orienteering Mappers International. There's a lot of good discussion. These are some really interesting ones from the previous week that was shared from Jeff Tuch from Canada. So he's got some challenging mapping going on there and decided to share some with the community. And let's have a look at the new symbol for these kind of multi-layer areas on the map here. Previously, in the old sprint symbol set, this whole area here would have just been kind of one color, that this pink color the whole way through. Or this pink color the whole way through. But now we've got this new striped symbol just to emphasize the fact that this is a multi-layered area in the terrain. You can stay on the footpath over here, or you can go through the bridge. This is the bridge symbol here. Or you can take the tunnel there. So this is the bridge, and then the dots are showing the tunnel. Or you can take the...
Okay, so you can go... So there's two ways you can cross the road. You can go through the tunnel, which is represented by the dots, or you can run over the top on the bridge.
I think, yeah. So this is a little bit strange because they've had to remove the out-of-bounds hatch from the top of the road. Mm-hmm. So this is why it's important to talk about these things, because it's kind of ambiguous in some cases. I doubt if you're allowed to run on the top of the road. They've just had to cut the out-of-bounds hatch, because otherwise it covers both layers.
Yep, got it. So there's actually, the only way through is through the tunnel.
The only way through is through the tunnel, and you've got to be really careful about that. It's pretty tricky, these multi-layered areas. And as a competitor, I'm more than happy for people to say, that's a bit strange, let's not use it for competition, because it's ambiguous. So these are some of the attempts to map these multi-layered areas. Let's have a look at another one. What is going on here, Tom?
That looks like, is that a tunnel in a tunnel?
Kind of.
Multi-layered tunnel? Oh, gosh.
So let's have a quick look at this. This is the bottom level here. So you're coming along, you've got these walls coming up. So I guess you're sinking in through the ground here, and then you go into a tunnel, and it's this inside series of dots here showing the passageway, and they continue all the way out. So there seems to be some tunnel the whole way through that they can get you through. But then if you come in at this level, so this is one level here, you've then got another tunnel as shown by these outside passageway dots. And this takes you out onto this level.
You've got a ramp which takes you up to the footpath.
And then you've got a third layer. You've got this layer up here where you're over top of everything. And again, I don't think you're crossing the main road. I don't think that's what it's communicating. But there's another layer here that you might be running across in another part of the course. But you wouldn't be crossing the top layer over the main kind of highway road here. So this is the first time I've seen a triple layer in orienteering.
That's pretty intense. Epsom Campus,
yeah.
Look out, another update coming. Right. Auckland, yeah. Uni.
Epsom Campus does have triple layer area, although it's just mapped as double layer, because there's not necessarily a great way to do that car park at Epsom Campus, but maybe they can get some tips from what's been done here. Here's another one to get your head around. So the way I would look at this to get your head straight is there's a big bridge going on here. You can see that's mapped with the bridge symbol the whole way along. So you know that that area is raised, and you can see that this is going downhill to the water. So this whole area here under the bridge, you can travel through here. But what's also important to note is where the passageway symbols, these little dots, show the passageway. What they're communicating to you is that there's a passageway in this area here, and it's distinctly different from the passageway in this area here. So basically, this is really an impassable wall, I suspect, under the bridge. Otherwise, those dots wouldn't be there. The whole thing would just be one single passageway. So it's possible to go under this bridge in two different places, under here and under here. And they are different. This one pops you out here, and this one pops you out into this dead end.
That's hectic. I would have to go and look at the map in the area, I think, to really get my head around that. But that's tricky.
And at speed, under race pressure, is very tricky. And I think you need to look at a number of these maps in advance before it becomes intuitive to exactly what's going on when you pick up the map on race day.
I think one of the big takeaways is that white crosshatch symbol means underpass or tunnel.
Yep. And previously, the dots are an old symbol that shows the passageway, but the dots are so much more obvious once you put this hash symbol over top. Definitely. You can really see the edge of the passageway a lot clearer. So I think that's a great upgrade to the symbol set, and allows for a little more, a little less ambiguity, less up to the interpretation of the runner, a little more clear, which I like.
Yeah. So something to remember and be aware of. Now, that's about it for our news this month. We've got some summer orienteering coming. Marlborough and Pepo have some Southern O-Week events. You might be there. I've got to work, unfortunately. And heading into summertime and holidays, there aren't a lot of other events, but how do you keep your orienteering skills honed over summer? What would you recommend? Yeah. Is there anything that you would do?
Yeah, there's a few things. I'm tempted by Salmon Ave in Auckland, but I have run on many of the areas so many times before that it doesn't actually hone my orienteering quite as much. It's an enjoyable run, so I totally rate it for that, and definitely go to Salmon Ave for that. I'm more interested in taking out some other kind of adventures now that we have all this LiDAR mapping going, as shown by Cam Delisle in last month's Nav Chat. Just look at this. This is Rangitoto Island in the Hauraki Gulf. It's all just like lava flows and stuff with some dense vegetation. This area is probably a no-go, but some of these clearings are lava flows and like scoria fields. It's runnable. Don't trip over, otherwise you're going to come back cut to shreds because of the scoria. But that is incredible. And even if the map isn't quite as nice as a fieldworked orienteering map, I think the level of vigilance required to navigate the stuff without losing contact with the map, I think is better practice than Summer Nav, actually. I think Summer Nav possibly teaches you to be a little bit lazy at times, and you can get away with just like daydreaming and then just relocating quite easily. Summer Nav's great, but this is a different thing. They do. They definitely
do. Do your faster sprint style navigation, and then if you want another, maybe your wife for the holiday somewhere else, grab a bit of NZO map or a bit of a topo.
I'm very interested to hear from the first person who takes this thing to Rangitoto Island and tries to navigate through these little clearings and over these little hills. It'll be fascinating to hear how it goes.
That's a challenge for the summer. Nice. Okay. Should we reconvene after New Year's and look at some more interesting orienteering people news and coaching tips?
Yep. I'm looking forward to Snapchat. The feedback I'm getting is great. I think people enjoy this. People like having the screen as opposed to just talking, a little more interactive. So I think we're going to keep doing this if the feedback stays good. And yeah, keep listening, keep sharing it around, and we can keep talking about the things we find most interesting in navigation with orienteering, Roganing, and event racing coming up next year also.
Cool. All right. I'll catch you later, Gene.
See you, Tom. Stay well.
You too. See ya.
If you liked the show, please support it by sharing this podcast with one person who would benefit from it. The best place to find more content like this is at genebeverage.nz, where you can find years of training blogs, race reports, podcasts, and coaching videos. If you don't want to miss future episodes, I recommend subscribing to my newsletter by visiting genebeverage.nz or by following on social media, Perfect Flow on Facebook and Gene Beverage on Instagram. For Q&A, send messages to nav@perfectflow.nz.